Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the New Books Network. I am Emily Allen, your host for this episode. And we have two guests with us today, Joanna and Tim Smolko, authors of Atomic Tunes, The Cold War, and American and British Popular Music, published by the Indiana University Press in 2021. And a little bit more about the book that we're discussing today. So during the Cold War, over 500 songs were written about nuclear weapons, fear of the Soviet Union, civil defense, bomb shelters, McCarthyism, uranium mining, the space race, espionage, the Berlin Wall, and Glasnost. So this book uncovers aspects of these world-changing events that documentaries and history books cannot. So in this book, Atomic Tunes, Tim and Joanna Smolko explore everything from the serious to the comical, the morbid to the crude, showing the widespread concern among musicians coping with the effect of communism on American society and the threat of nuclear conflict of global proportions. Atomic Tunes presents a musical history of the Cold War, analyzing the songs that capture the fear of those who lived under the shadow of Stalin, Sputnik, mushroom clouds, and missiles. So a little bit more about our visitors with us today. First, Joanna Smolko holds a PhD in musicology and currently serves as adjunct professor of music at the Hugh Hodgson School of Music at the University of Georgia. And finally, Tim Smolko holds master's degrees in musicology and library science and is Monograph's original cataloger at the University of Georgia. So welcome to both of you. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah. And so we're excited to have you here at the New Books Network. And before we talk about your book, can you tell us more about yourself? So we'll start with Joanna first, and then Tim, if you want to tell us more about you after that.
Hi, I'm a musicologist, or sometimes my work straddles the parallel field of ethnomusicology. And my specialty is American music traditions. So musicologists study the history of music and its relationship to culture, art, and music. I teach at the University of Georgia, and my research interests range across classical, popular, and folk music topics. Some of these include sacred harp hymn traditions, the music of Bob Dylan and Bruce Springsteen, protest music, and film music. I also like exploring intersections between musical traditions. For example, my dissertation was on the use of sacred harp music in classical music and film scores. I'm also a freelance editor and academic coach, and I teach piano, ukulele, and guitar to children.
Okay, I'm Tim. I'm the other half of our dynamic duo. I'm also a musicologist, but my main gig is working as a librarian at the University of Georgia. So I've been a cataloger there for almost 15 years, I create original cataloging records for new books for WorldCat. I'm also an author. I write mostly about rock music. My first book was about one of my favorite bands, the British progressive rock band Jethro Tull. I also play the drums, and I teach drums in our basement. It's very loud down there. I also edit theses and dissertations, and I'm a record collector with over 2,000 records. On a personal note, we have 14-year-old twins, and our favorite thing we like to do with them is to travel and to eat.
Right on. That sounds, y'all are awesome as the dynamic duo, as you put it. Yes, but I'm excited to have y'all here with us today. And then kind of shifting gears to this current project that y'all have been working on, you know, how did Atomic Tunes get started? You know, what are the roots, the genesis here of this whole thing? If Tim, you can talk about that for us.
Sure. Well, after I got my first book done, I was hunting around for a new idea. And one day I was just listening to the radio, and I three songs in a row came on that happened to be about the Cold War. And I think they were 99 Red Balloons by Nina, Russians by Sting, and Crazy Train by Ozzy Osbourne. And I just happened to notice that, you know, all three songs had something to do with, you know, Cold War issues. And then I started looking around in the library, and I saw that there were books written about songs out of World War I and World War II. And I found a lot of books, of course, about the Vietnam War protest songs. But I had not found a book about songs that address issues about the Cold War, you know, from the mid-40s to the early 90s, the whole span of the conflict. So I started looking for songs, and I started making a list, and the list grew and grew. And I started talking to Joanna about it, and she had a lot of good ideas, and it just sort of snowballed from there.
Yes, that is teamwork at its finest, it sounds like.
Yeah. As part of it, I really had an interest in the women who were singing about these issues, as well as people like Bob Dylan and Bruce Springsteen, who had really wonderful songs that address some of these things. So I jumped right in when he said, oh, we need to look at these things. And I said, yes, I want to look at those things in particular.
Yeah, it's very complimentary, and I think you see that throughout the book. Now that you've kind of described sort of your different interest in it, I think you see both of your voices throughout the project in that way, which is pretty cool. When you have, you know, co-authored projects like that, kind of seeing each contributor's sort of approach to that. And speaking of which, you know, in terms of the research process that, you know, led to the final product, can you tell us a little bit more about that in terms of, like, you started getting at this a little bit, Tim, but maybe elaborate a bit more on sort of the sources, you know, and different archives that you explored for this?
Well, we didn't do a whole lot of archival research because we were looking at, you know, popular songs. We weren't, like, looking at, like, sheet music or correspondence or stuff like that that a lot of traditional musicologists might do. One thing that really helped me find a lot of songs was a 5-CD set that came out in 2005 called Atomic Platters. It was produced by a company in Germany called Bear Records, and it has over 100 songs with Cold War themes from like the 1940s to the 1960s. And it's an excellent collection. And it comes with a, you know, a big book with lots of photographs, but it didn't have like a deep analysis of the songs. It had a lot of biographical information. So I started with that, and I started, you know, finding a lot of songs from the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s to add to it. But that 5-CD set was like a big catalyst in finding a lot of the songs. But we found a lot of songs on YouTube, you know, just searching online, just talking to our friends and colleagues about this, you know, this topic, and songs just came out of the woodwork. We just found them here, there, and everywhere. Do you have anything to add, Joanna?
Mm-hmm. So I would say we could call YouTube one of our main archives, because so many people have taken some of the more obscure songs, especially from the 1950s, and put them up there. So we were able to access things that we wouldn't have been able to access in a million years before YouTube provided this vast resource. One thing that was interesting that I really loved was we had the opportunity to correspond with some of the people connected with these issues. So one of my favorite research opportunities was talking to Nancy Schimmel, who is the daughter of Malvina Reynolds. If you've ever heard Little Boxes, you've heard one of Malvina Reynolds' songs. She was very kind. She sent me biographical information about her mother's life and photographs. And she talked to me about how some of this work has been carried on into the present. So Nancy herself has been part of an organization called the Occupellas, punning off of the Occupy movement, that trains people on how to use protest music within their events. I was also able to briefly correspond with Peggy Seeger, who read our chapter on women songwriters and appreciated the depth of discussion that I in particular gave to her songs. So the opportunity to connect with these kinds of people was just phenomenal. And I believe Tim had the opportunity to correspond with one of the artists who graffitied on the Berlin Wall. So somebody who was right there on the ground during the time of these historic events.
Yeah, so it was, in Berlin, West Berlin in the 80s, people were getting so sick of the Berlin Wall, so they started to do graffiti on it. And there was a French street artist named Thierry Noir, who was one of the first people to paint on the Berlin Wall. And his paintings made it into a film called Berliner Blau, which is about West Germany's sort of attitude and reaction against the Berlin Wall. Anyways, how this connects to music is that one day, it was not him, it was another artist who wrote the title of Sting's song, If You Love Somebody, Set Them Free, which is on his first solo album from 1985. So Noir saw this and started painting a mural under it, and it became one of the most iconic murals on the Berlin Wall. Before, it was there for like 2 or 3 years, and with this thing, other artists would paint over other artists' work, so it was like, oh, it was always changing. But that image of, like, you know, it has these like five faces underneath the title of the Sting song, If You Love Somebody, Set Them Free. And in many ways, that became like one of the catchphrases of the movement to unify Germany, you know, once again. So that sort of chipped away at the wall a little bit with art and music.
Yeah, and as you kind of have in the synopsis of the book, you know, it's interesting what these different sources can bring to the table on this topic besides just traditional, like you said in the synopsis, like documentaries and history books don't. So this is kind of an interesting added resource to the existing research on, you know, Cold War history in that way.
That's right. And I think one thing that comes out of these songs is the viewpoint of ordinary people on the ground. Still, so much of our history is written about the big players, the big battles, the rulers, and so forth. And these songs are like little snapshots of how people perceived and experienced the world. So even the songs that are not functioning as protest songs per se still are giving reactions that ordinary people had. One very poignant song we talk about is Bob Dylan's song, Let Me Die in My Footsteps. And this is his response to a childhood memory of door-to-door bomb shelter salespeople coming through his small Midwestern town. And according to his chronicles, the townspeople, as if one voice, said, no, I can't put a bomb shelter in my yard because what would happen to my neighbors? So they made a conscious choice to put neighborly love in the present over fear of what might come in the future. So it's a very poignant and personal song.
So, like, for example, that's not something you would find in a history book. So these songs are like social history, you know, the history of history from the bottom up instead of from the top down.
Yeah, that's really cool. And Joanna, I'm curious how you talk about all this, like, in your classes. I know you'd mentioned to me that you've started using this book, you know, in your teaching. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I had the opportunity to develop a seminar class for undergraduates on protest music with this book. So because we organized our book thematically, mostly by topic area, combined with genre and time period, I've used the book as the basis of that class as a way to talk about other issues outside of the Cold War as well. So far, I'm teaching it this semester. The students have been very enthusiastic, and we've sparked a number of conversations that take the issues from this historical time period, from the 1940s to the 80s, up into the present. So some of the issues our book covers are ecology, gender issues, American exceptionalism, peace, war, technology, economic equity, moral dilemmas, racism, immigration, and so forth. So you can even hear in that list how many of those issues are still prevalent today. So the structure of our class, we've been covering a chapter each week, and the students will present on readings on one day, and then they'll do song analyses on another day. So it's been really interesting to see how they interact with the background reading and then apply it to the specific songs and lyrics, thinking about the music, thinking about the textual style, thinking about the history and context, and always they bring it into the present. So by the end of the class, they're all going to do an essay and some kind of creative response. So they could do an oral history with somebody. They could write a protest song. I know that some of them are planning to write their own protest songs. They could do a performance or a podcast. So I'm really excited to see what they come up with. So some of the things that stood out to me with the teaching so far, one week we listened to Peggy Seeger's song, 4 Minute Warning, which is a song exactly 4 minutes long, where she sings about how places in England would experience a nuclear bomb if the drop point were in London. So it radiates outwards in a circle as she names different places across England and how they would experience the disaster. So after we listened to it, we pulled out a map and looked at the different places that would be affected as it radiated out. And it was very poignant looking at the actual cities. And even near the ending point, she ends up in Dover. But then you look and right across the channel, you have France. So it was a good moment to look at geography and history as people would have experienced it had that happened. And the end of the song is, this has been your 4 minute warning. So it puns on the warnings that people would get about, you know, practicing for a disaster, but also the song itself is functioning as a warning. Stop this before it even happens. I've also found that students really want to know. They want to know some of these tougher parts of American history. So in one class, we were talking about the history of Navajo people working in uranium mines in Utah. And one of my students said, why have we not learned about this before? Why was I a senior in college before hearing about this? They want to know the issues, both the good issues and the hard issues. We've documented these issues thoroughly, but as part of it, we really address our book to the general public and academic audiences. So when I think about how this book could be used in other situations, this would be a wonderful book to use in an American history class. And I believe high school or college classes could use this. It could be used in a history of protest music taken from a historical point of view, or even a women's studies course, as we're looking at the role of women and especially the intersectional issues that come through their songs. Another viewpoint, this could be used in a course on American literature because we were able to obtain permission to include entire song lyrics for a number of songs. So I think this would be a wonderful course to study how the words are used, the rhetoric of these songs, for example. We already know it's been being used in a couple of other classrooms, so we're really excited to see how it will continue to be used.
Well, that's interesting to hear because just kind of a side note or side thought here as you were talking, you know, right now there's sort of this big reckoning with the way history is being taught, right? With the sort of quote unquote critical race theory, you know, witch hunt that's happening. And it sounds like that this book really helps students to not totally comfortably, but from what you're saying, like deal with these things that are being misconstrued in mainstream media and whatnot.
Right. And I would say, you know, Tim, as a librarian, brings this care to archival research. We have documented thoroughly the issues that we talk about. So there's also things like FBI records being opened up, other kinds of documentations. We've thoroughly documented what we've stated in the book. So we're bringing the receipts, so to speak. And it's something that we feel is a responsible part of being a citizen, is to understand our history, both the good and the bad parts. So there are definitely things that we looked at, and we looked at the original documents, and we were truly shocked. It was like parts of our history we almost didn't want to know about, but as responsible citizens, we need to know what has happened, good, bad, hard, complicated, because we need to be able to make informed choices as citizens and do better than some of these parts of our history. So, we do touch on in our class and other conversations that I have, the idea of patriotism and protest are not antithetical. We protest to make things better. We protest to bring attention to those issues. And sometimes I even encourage students to use the term advocacy. And we talk about a spectrum between things that are pointing out how we failed, whether it's in a topical song that deals with a specific moment in time, or something that's dealing with issues that are more universal, like poverty and injustice and racial equality. You can point out something that's bad, but you can also work to make it better. So many of these songs are bringing attention to how we can make repairs, how we can fix things, how we can look forward to the future by making better decisions in the present.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini,
and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Cool. Thank you. And, you know, following up here with a question to Tim, you know, can you talk a little bit about a couple of other interesting song examples from the book, you know, in terms of like what genres are sort of represented here? And sort of what your takeaways from those are.
Okay, so the main styles of music which we found the most songs in are folk music, country, comedy, early rock and rockabilly, blues, calypso, mainstream rock, heavy metal, punk, and new wave. So we have chapters devoted to most of those styles of music. And we learned so much about the history of popular music in writing this book. You know, we found songs, we found the weirdest songs. You would not believe how weird some of these songs are. And genres, it's interesting, like most of the songs we found espouse, you know, left-wing liberal viewpoints, as you would expect. But we did find some right-wing songwriters. And ironically, you know, some of the most prevalent right-wing songwriters were in folk. So you have these right-wing folk musicians. I mean, when you think of folk music, you think of like Woody Guthrie and Pete Seeger and all these lefties. But there were some right-wing folk singers who were writing about the Korean War and the Vietnam War, and they weren't necessarily saying this is a good war and it should happen. They were saying it needs to happen because we need to stop the spread of communism. And they were also just trying to support the troops. You know, we can't have a divided America because the troops are depending on us. So if the war is necessary, let's back the troops. But then the lefties are there saying, well, the troops shouldn't be there anyways. They shouldn't be there in the first place. So it was really fun finding these right-wing folk musicians. Another interesting thing we found when writing the book is how many musicians actually traveled to places where the Cold War was happening. Like in 1972, Joan Baez traveled to Hanoi in North Vietnam to deliver mail to American prisoners of war. So she was part of this entourage that went over there at this dangerous time to do that. And she happened to be there during this massive bombing raid. It was called the Christmastime Bombing, Linebacker 2. It was one of the biggest bombing raids in the Vietnam War. So she spent most of her time in bomb shelters. I'm not even sure if she got to deliver the Christmas letters to the POWs. So she was like right there in the thick of it. And then Billy Joel, you know, is the first musician to play large-scale rock concerts in Moscow and Leningrad. In the middle of the 80s, Sting goes to Chile, and Bono from U2 travels to Nicaragua and El Salvador. And they both went there to assist refugees and to, you know, understand how the war was affecting Latin Americans. And they both wrote songs about their experiences, which we talk about in the book. And then John Denver goes over to Moscow and plays a benefit concert to raise money for the Chernobyl accident cleanup. So you have all these interactions with musicians who want to find out what's going on firsthand. And they go to these dangerous places and survive and come back and write songs about them. So that was really interesting to find that out.
Yeah. Was there anything that surprised either of you as you were going through this process of, you know, going through all these songs? Was there anything that kind of stood out to you and you were like, whoa, did not expect that.
Well, I have a couple of things to follow up on some of the things that Tim was talking about. One thing I found very interesting is that some of the songwriters who are viewed now as left-wing were actually veterans of World War II. So one corrective, I think, that needs to happen as we assess their historical work, looking at Woody Guthrie and Pete Seeger, these were people who were veterans of World War II, and they saw one of the greatest threats coming as fascism. So it wasn't just being, what we would now label as left-wing, but it was also being anti-fascist. They saw this encroach that happened, and some of the things happening within McCarthyism confirmed that for them. So we're talking about real life experience that informed and shaped their kind of American patriotism. They saw this as a real threat, and then other people were fighting a different kind of war against encroaching communism. So the Cold War versus continuing to see issues that had spurred on World War II. Another thing that really surprised me, talking about the right-wing songwriters, Janet Green was one of those songwriters, and she is a fascinating person because one of her roles was to play Cinderella on a local network for children, and she got sexually harassed by her boss, and she ended up suing him and winning. And this is pretty early on. I believe it was the early 60s. So we make sure whichever viewpoint songwriters are coming from, we want to present their ideas in a respectful way, because all of us need to be good citizens, right? So we try to tell the stories in the full complexity. And some of these, their stories are just fascinating as you look closer at people, not just as a parody, not just as an ahistorical person, but as people who are working in a time and a place with access to some information and maybe not access to other information, and seeing how that shapes the songwriting that happened.
Yeah, there's one more thing I'd like to add to what Joanna said. You know, she mentioned that Pete Seeger and Woody Guthrie and some other folk singers were World War II veterans. And what I had known that Jimi Hendrix served in the military before he became guitar virtuoso, but I had not looked into it, and it was really fascinating to learn, you know, that he was he went through basic training and he trained as a paratrooper and the 101st Screaming Eagles. You know, it's the band of brothers fame who parachuted, you know, into Europe. He never served active duty. He was never stationed anywhere outside the United States. This was the early 60s. So it was before the Vietnam War, you know, really ramped up, you know, 1965, 1966. But he was a soldier, and I never think of Jimi Hendrix as a soldier. He was only in the military for a year, and then he was sort of like deemed unfit for service because he had no interest in shooting guns and he just wanted to play his guitar. So, and that really, the fact that he was a soldier really shapes our view of his version of the Star Spangled Banner, you know, which he played, you know, over 100 times. And of course, during Woodstock, we see him as the emblem of like countercultural protest of the left. But before the, like in 1967, because, you know, just as he was becoming, you know, really famous, he was actually supporting the Vietnam War because he saw, you know, fellow soldiers fighting it, and he thought communism was a great threat. He changed his mind, you know, a year or two later, and his views sort of matched more with the counterculture. But he was one of those figures that saw both sides of it. He was an insider and an outsider to the military. He was an African-American in the military, a minority. He was a minority in the rock world. So, of course, Jimi Hendrix is a fascinating character, and it all comes out in his guitar playing. So,
yeah, that's such a rich, perspective of those famous performances he did. That's something I've used a lot in my classes, for instance, and I think a lot of people end up bringing that Woodstock performance in, I've noticed, in different courses. So y'all need to read this book. It paints this very complex picture that they're talking about here. And just kind of talking a little bit more about sort of the ways this book is being presented. I noticed that you have, for instance, on your website, some blog posts or what you call quote unquote extra stuff, so how do those posts, complement the book? Do you have other ideas of what you're planning to also do with this project? Tim, if you want to talk about that.
Yeah, we found so much to write about that we essentially wrote like a 500-page book, and our publisher was like, that's too long. So we compromised, and we have a nice, thick 350-page book, which we're very proud of. But then we had all this extra stuff, which we took out, which was like fully finished and, ready to be part of the book. So we thought, well, we have to use this somehow. And so in the weeks leading up to the release of our book, which is May of last year, we started just, releasing an article a week on our website, like as teasers or as like a sneak peek. So on our website, smokily.com, we have I'll get it, Joanna.
It's smoko.ly. Smokily.
Yes.
So thank L-Y you. Is the...
I know it's kind of weird, but that's what it was. So we have sections about U2, the Beatles, Elvis Presley, Elton John, Billy Joel, Sting, Burl Ives, and music videos from the 1980s. So there's a lot of great stuff on there. If you're interested in looking at it and see what the book is like, just read through those articles and you'll get a good taste of what our book is like.
We're also including Spotify lists for each of the chapters. So we want people to have this as a multi-sensory experience. Read the book, but also listen to the music. So we've included that on our website as well.
Cool. That really, brings it to life for folks in more ways than one. That's really cool to have, like you said, that multi-sensory approach. And I kind of wanted to open the floor to Joanna here and Tim too, if you have anything to add. In terms of what we've talked about so far, is there anything else about your book Atomic Tunes that you'd like to touch on that we haven't already had the chance to discuss? Joanna, you can start.
Yes. One thing that stood out to me throughout the research was how intersectional these issues were within the songs. So many of these songs are not single issue songs. So when Peggy Seeger and Malvina Reynolds sing about the dangers of fallout radiation, they connect it to ecology, feminism, family. We have in Malvina's song, What Have They Done to the Rain? She responds to nuclear fallout from the bomb testing at the Nevada test site. And this became part of the Women's Strike for Peace movement that happened in the early 1960s. So when I'm teaching from this book, sometimes I'll use the term historical artifact or musical artifact. So this idea that these songs are evidence of what's happening in the culture, but there's a few songs, like What Have They Done to the Rain, that are historical actors. They actually help to change and shift viewpoints around the issues. So this Women's Strike for Peace movement helped lead to the treaty that banned nuclear testing above ground, on water, or in outer space. And it was led by women who started a letter writing campaign not just to President Kennedy, but to Jackie Kennedy, to Khrushchev and his wife. They're like, if we can't get the men to see it, we're going to get the women to see it. And it worked. That treaty, as far as I know, still has not been violated. So the songs were part of the history, not just reflecting the history.
That's cool. Thank you for telling us about that. That's really fascinating. Tim, did you have anything you wanted to add?
Yeah. So most of the book, we talk about lyrics and music. But there's many other ways that musicians, you know, express their viewpoints. You know, they design their album covers and even their, you know, their 45 singles. They came with a sleeve also, and they hired artists to do specific artwork. Like if a song is about, you know, a nuclear topic, it has, you know, the cover reflects that. They also, we found so many interviews of musicians speaking about songs they'd written about the Cold War, and then they flesh out their experiences, perhaps an experience from their childhood. Like the drummer of Rush, Neil Peart. Rush wrote many Cold War songs, and Neil Peart was their lyricist, and he grew up in a part of Canada which is not far from Niagara Falls. So he was about 10 years old when the Cuban Missile Crisis happened. So he's 10 years old, learning about the Cuban Missile Crisis, and he knows that Niagara Falls is about 10 miles away, and Niagara Falls generates water for one of the biggest hydroelectric plants in Canada and eastern United States. So it was one of the targets. It was one of the Soviet targets. So if you have that information in your mind when you're 10 years old, it's going to affect you the rest of your life. And if you become a creative person and a writer, it's going to come out in your writing. So, and I'd been a Rush fan like all my life. I never knew that aspect of his childhood, that his father, you know, he couldn't afford a bomb shelter in their house. So they made this like little, they found the safest place in the house in the basement, and they stocked canned food and water. So they did the whole bomb shelter thing when he was 10 years old. So it's amazing stuff.
Yeah, that's wild. That would be like a life changing or like life altering, I guess, rather like experience. Gosh, I can't even imagine doing that, you know, as a kid. But yeah, thank y'all so much for talking with us about this really rich book. And I hope people take a look at it. And like you were saying, there's a lot that resonates with our current climate that I think people would take away from reading this. And, you know, looking ahead for both of you, you know, what other projects are you working on next? Tim, if you want to go first and talk about your other work you're doing right now, and then Joanna after that.
Yeah, well, I continue to write about progressive rock. There's a book coming out in a year or two. It's called The Cambridge Companion to Progressive Rock, and I have a chapter in there about Jethro Tull. I actually don't like to repeat myself. Like when I try to think of like new projects as like being in sort of the same general area of popular music, but I couldn't resist, you know, this offer. So. But yeah, we're looking for something different, something new. And I think Joanna can talk more about that than I can. So Joanna?
Mm-hmm. So my recent work includes, in 2021, I co-edited a volume called Christian Sacred Music in the Americas, where we explore sacred music traditions from a number of different cultural groups within South and Central America, as well as the US and Canada. So I'm continuing my work with sacred music, especially researching sacred harp hymns, looking at some of that in our local Athens area, historically in the 19th century into the 20th century. Tim and I are also looking at a couple of other joint projects on popular music. One might be looking at some sacred music influences on the development of rock. Another thing we've shopped around is the idea of looking at how popular music functions within nostalgic television, especially coming of age sorts of series.
Cool. I'll look forward to reading a lot of that. That sounds really interesting. I'm excited to see the work that you all continue to do. Thank you all so much for joining us on the New Books Network today.
Thank you for this opportunity.
Yeah, thanks for having us. We had a great time.
Yeah, and just listeners, as a quick recap, you just heard a discussion with Joanna and Tim Smolko, co-authors of Atomic Tunes, The Cold War in American and British Popular Music, published by Indiana University Press in 2021. And this is your host, Emily Allen, and I'll catch you next time here on the New Books Network. Thank you.